TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Dr. Aaron Thierry, The Brutal Logic of Climate Change. An open network of students, staff, and the community at the University of Sheffield in England meets regularly to find solutions that will make the university carbon neutral by 2025. At their March 2017 meeting, they heard a talk by Dr. Aaron Thierry. He says, "Recent events in the U.S. illustrate just how widespread and influential climate denial has become, with potentially catastrophic implications for all of us." Aaron Thierry asks what we can do to better promote scientific understanding of this crucial issue. Aaron Thierry received his PhD in ecology from the University of Sheffield and teaches at their Department of Animal and Plant Sciences. Thanks to CNU, that's Carbon Neutral University at Sheffield, for organizing and recording this talk and posting it on YouTube. The title card is a quote by Martin Luther King. "There is such a thing as being too late. This is no time for apathy or complacency. This is a time for vigorous and positive action." Here's Dr. Aaron Thierry.
My talk, The Brutal Logic of Climate Change. I won't explain why it's called that just yet, but hopefully it'll become apparent as we go through. I see myself as a scientist by training. I went and studied how climate change is impacting on ecosystems in the Arctic for my postdoc. Although much of this talk is me as a scientist trying to convey scientific information, it's also a talk where I'm trying to get you to do something. So I'm speaking here as an advocate. I'm very open about that. I have values. I'm a human being, and some of those values are informed by what I've learnt. I think scientists need to be able to do that. I think scientists should do that and should do that more often. Okay, but firstly, the very basics of climate science. I'm not going to go into this in a lot of detail because I'm sure you already know it. You got the sun gives out shortwave radiation. That radiation arrives at the Earth and warms the temperature of the planet. Some of that would then be lost again to space because of outgoing shortwave radiation, but atmospheric gases that we call greenhouse gases absorb some of that and keep that heat around the planet and increase the temperature of the planet. We know that as the greenhouse effect. One of those gases is carbon dioxide. We've been putting out lots of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere as a result of burning fossil fuels, oil, coal, and gas. And as a result, the temperature of the planet is going up. Simple. We know, looking at historical records, that temperatures are very closely related to the level of CO2 in the atmosphere. We get this data from drilling ice cores in Greenland and Antarctica, where we can look at the air from really long ago that's been trapped in the snow layers, which are then frozen into ice. And that can tell us what the concentration of CO2 was in the past. And likewise, we can analyze the water molecules to tell us what the temperature was in the past as well. And we can go back very, very long periods of time, so the last 400,000 years. And what we see is that there's a cycle, which we call the Ice Age cycle. And those cycles typically last about 100,000 years. And you can see just how closely related both the temperature and carbon dioxide levels are to each other. The other two really important things to pick out here, that there's a stable period. That's the period we know as the Holocene. It's the last 10,000 years or so. And basically, the whole of human civilization has taken place during that period. We're talking about the creation of agriculture, settlement around the world, Roman Empire, the Egyptians, all of it. That's in that tiny bit at the end of the timeline there. The other thing to notice is if you follow the blue line to the end, you'll see it suddenly spike up. And that's the result of us burning fossil fuels and putting it into the atmosphere. And as a result of that, temperatures are starting to increase as well. I grew up in North Wales, in Snowdonia. I feel very blessed to have grown up there. I love these mountains. And if you hike up one of them like this, up to summit of Penarol y Wen, and look out, you can see Ogwen Valley, or the Nant Francon, and the different coombs going down, the gullies going down the sides of the mountains. Those were formed by glaciers at the height of the last ice age. If you'd been up that hill 20,000 years ago, you'd have seen the Merionith ice cap, with just the summits of those hills just poking out amongst this sea of ice as little islands. Across the whole of Europe and Scandinavia was a massive ice cap, and then south of France was basically a tundra, and Spain and Italy were coniferous forests like you'd see around Russia today. How big a change was that between the last ice age and today? And that's roughly 4.5 degrees Celsius change on the global scale. It doesn't sound like a lot, but it's made a huge difference to the whole of the world, okay? That 4.5 degrees. And if we were to go the equivalent change into a warmer planet, that's the question mark. So if we go 1 unit warmer, 4.5 degrees warmer, what would the world look like? And the answer is we're going to find out in 86 years' time if we don't do something about it, because that's how much we're expected to warm. That's why I would say that we're now facing a climate emergency. Sounds alarmist, doesn't it? But I'm not saying that. That's what this man says, Ban Ki-moon, who was the former head of the United Nations. This is an emergency, and for emergency situations, we need emergency action. He's saying that because that's what the scientists are saying. James Hansen, former director of NASA, Goddard Institute for Space Studies, we are in a planetary emergency. Professor John Horton, former co-chair of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, climate change is accelerating more rapidly and dangerously than most of us in the scientific community had expected. Lonnie Thompson, professor of Bird Polar Research Center, he's one of these guys who goes out and takes these ice cores that I was telling you about before. Virtually all of us are now convinced that global warming poses a clear and present danger to civilization. So if that's what scientists are saying and thinking, why is that not a message that we hear repeated and reported more often in the media? 2016 was the hottest year on record. That was surpassing 2015, which was previously the hottest year on record, which surpassed 2014, which was previously the hottest year on record. If we carry on warming the planet as we are doing, then this is what we're going to see. All of civilization has evolved to cope with the stability that this last 10,000 years has provided us. Indeed, some people would say that's the reason that civilization happened when it did, because you could start predicting when the rains were going to fall, you could predict how much rain you were going to get, you could predict where the sea levels were going to be, you could predict how high the floods would rise. But we're going to go out of that. We're leaving that behind. And it's the extremes that matter. So that was just the average temperature. But what we need to understand is that's the climate, but what happens on a daily basis is weather. These really hot extreme temperatures that we never used to see happen are now happening. And the analysis concluded that this hot extreme, which covered much less than 1% of the Earth's surface, now typically covers 10% of Earth's land area. And this is only with 1 degree of warming, okay? The Met Office and the Hadley Centre, which do a lot of climate change modelling in the UK, carried out an analysis and they said, well, what would these extremes look like if we warmed the planet by 4 degrees? Their conclusion was that for a 4 degree mean surface temperature increase, then on the hottest days of the year, the temperature in China would be 6 to 8 degrees hotter than it currently is on the hottest days. In Central Europe, the temperatures would be 8 to 10 degrees hotter than the hottest days that they've currently experienced. And likewise in New York, it would be 10 to 12 degrees hotter. You can just imagine the kind of impact that that has on the infrastructure of a city, on growing crops. I was in France on holiday in 2003 when one of these extreme heat waves struck. And it was unbearable. I was camping at the time and you literally could not stay in your tent after the sun rose. We used to spend our days kind of running around between supermarkets to use their air conditioning. I can remember that. About 15,000 people estimated extra died in France as a result of that. In fact, across the whole of Europe that summer, it's estimated that the number is closer to 70,000 people excess deaths that summer. By 2040, that's going to be an average summer. And by 2060, most summers will be warmer than that. All right, so that's in our lifetime. That's in our kids' lifetime. What does that mean in terms of drought, for example? So this graph here shows you how dry the soils are in different parts of the world. It's known as the Palmer Drought Severity Index. And we can see by about 2060, much of the breadbasket of the United States is experiencing those kind of dry temperatures. Likewise, much of the Mediterranean, and the area around Turkey and Ukraine, and also northern Brazil by the later century. All of these areas are becoming very, very, very arid at that point. So going to the future, what will that look like? Well, if we can switch to a low emission scenario, we have a hope of holding it to this one, where it does carry on drying out. But if we don't and carry on with a high emission scenario, then most of the United States is going to look like a dust bowl, as well as Latin America. We're already seeing droughts like this happening around the world. So this is from Brazil, where Sao Paulo, the largest city in South America, almost had to be evacuated because of a drought crisis. India, 330 million people affected by drought last year. And this was from 2010. There was a heat wave, an extreme heat wave, like the one that happened in France, that struck Russia, and it caused wildfires that burnt through much of their harvest. As much as 40% of their harvest was lost, and they had to declare an export embargo in Russia. That had a consequence, and that was that food prices around the world went skyrocketing. This is a measure of the food price index. It's a measure of food prices around the world. And you can see that there was two spikes, one in 2008 and then another one 2010-11. The one in 2008, most people associate with a switch in policy towards including more grains in biofuels, whereas the one in 2010, people say, is related both to the drought and extreme wildfires in Russia, which led to the embargo, and also another drought that happened in China at the same time, so it was the two together. But in both cases, you had this huge price spike, and these red lines show you incidences of food rioting that took place around the world and the names of different countries. And if I draw your attention to the second spike, you can see names like Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, Yemen, Syria. Now, I'm not saying that the two things are directly related, but Egypt at the time was the world's largest grain importer. It imported more wheat than any other country. And cost of living went through the roof. They couldn't afford to buy bread, so they went out on the streets and they started chanting for bread, freedom, and social justice. And bread was a key priority when people came out in the Arab Spring. We now know that that drought in Russia was about five times more likely to have happened because of climate change. And again, I'm not trying to say that climate change caused the war of Syria or anything as simple as that, but it was a factor. Why do I say that? Well, Syria has been drying out over the last 100 years. And in 2006 to 2007, there was an exceptional drought. It was the worst drought now we know for over 900 years. And there was fewer than 50% of normal rainfall in those areas. 85% of livestock died in much of northern Syria, and farmers were forced to abandon land and head to the cities. About 1.5 million people left the land and moved to Homs and Damascus and other major cities. At the same time, those cities were already stressed by the fact that war in Iraq had caused another million people to leave their homes and move to Syria. And then the price spike hit. And again, people went out on the street asking for assistance, and the government cracked down and repressed its people. So again, I'm not saying climate change caused this, but it was a factor. And we now know that this century-long observed trends in precipitation, temperature, and sea level pressure, supported by climate model results, strongly suggest that anthropogenic forcing has made the occurrence of a three-year drought as severe as that of the 2007 to 2010, 2 to 3 times more likely than by natural variability alone. This is a cable from the US Embassy that was leaked through WikiLeaks in 2008. And the US Embassy sent a message back saying, Syria's UN Food and Agricultural Representative told us that the Syrian Minister of Agriculture stated publicly that economic and social fallout from the drought was beyond our capacity as a country to deal with. This social destruction would lead to political instability. And indeed, that was the case. And 2 years later, the civil war broke out. This is some work done by Oxfam looking at agricultural prices for commodities and how they're expected to increase up to 2030 compared with 2010. The dark green shows the baseline, so how much food price is expected to increase as a result of changing population, changing diets, and so on and so forth. The dashed green line represents the additional increase that climate stresses is going to cause to that price. for example, wheat, they're predicting a 120% increase in the cost of wheat by 2030 compared to 2010. And for maize, it's 180% almost. You've got to bear in mind that for many families around the world, they're still struggling and often spending, you know, half their income on food. So this is almost doubling the price again. And that doesn't even take into account a price shock like the ones I was just telling you about. So imagine that you had the same drought as you had in the US in 2012. What would that do to the global food prices then in this scenario in 2030? Well, according to Oxfam's research, they said that that price shock would cause an additional 33% increase in wheat prices, an additional 140% increases in maize prices. So if you take the maize price, for example, that's now almost 5.5 times more than it currently costs. So partly as a result of water scarcity, partly as a result of food scarcity, and many other things, the WHO have said that climate change will affect in profoundly adverse ways some of the most fundamental determinants of health. Another one that they stress is the way at which disease will change as vectors migrate around the world. It's not just temperatures that will be changing, it's also the amount of flooding, wildfires, extreme storms that are happening. And indeed, we're already seeing that that's the case. So this is data from the World Meteorological Organization, the WMO, which shows the number of reported disasters by decade, categorized by different hazard types. So we've got floods, storms, droughts, extreme temperatures, wildfires. And you can see that these things are all increasing. And they're increasing in line with our projections. Actually, they're increasing faster. So this is John Holdren, who's the former US Presidential Science Advisor, who was also former president of the AAAS, the American Academy for Arts and Sciences. He says, everything that is expected to result from global climate change driven by greenhouse gases is not only happening, but it's happening faster than anybody expected. And we're seeing floods, extreme floods, record floods around the world constantly. This is just from last year, 2016. So we've got the UK here, 2015 to 2016, the flooding in Cumbria. We've got Texas, Sri Lanka, France and Paris, Wuhan in China, Louisiana again in the US, North Korea, 100,000 people were displaced by flooding in North Korea, South Africa, Spain. It's happening everywhere. And if we take, for example, the UK example from 2015 to 2016, if we take the whole of December and look at the amount of rainfall that fell in December and compare that to average, some parts of the UK, in Cumbria and North Wales, for example, saw 300% the average rainfall for that region in that month. So where that was for where my parents live in North Wales, well, that was a metre of rain that fell in that month. That's more than we'd normally see in a whole year at that area. And we saw extreme flooding as a result. So this Dame Professor Julia Slingo, she was former chief scientist at the UK Met Office. She said that all the evidence suggests that there is a link to climate change. There is no evidence to counter the basic premise that a warmer world will lead to more intense daily and hourly rain events. Frederica Otto from the University of Oxford, who carried out an analysis of this, which found that this flooding was about 50 to 75% more likely to have happened because of climate change than it would have if climate change hadn't happened, says that greenhouse gas emissions are loading the weather dice towards these warmer, wetter winters. If we change and cast our eyes up to the Arctic, we see that there are rapid changes going on there as well. This is the minimum sea ice extent at the end of summer. So the sea ice grows in winter and then shrinks again in summer. This graph at the top shows you what it shrunk to in 1979 when the satellites first started recording this data. This bottom graph shows you the extent of the sea ice in 2012, which is the lowest it's ever got to at currently in the summer. You can see all that extra area of blue, which is absorbing heat and warming the planet more. This is Mark Cerise, who's director of the National Snow and Ice Data Centre. He says, we may lose the summer sea ice cover as early as the 2030. This is, in itself, much earlier than projections from nearly all climate model simulations. So when sea ice melts, it doesn't raise sea levels because it's already floating. But when ice on land melts and flows to the sea, that raises sea levels because you're putting more mass into the oceans. And so we're seeing that both Greenland and Antarctica are now losing mass at an accelerating rate. And that's causing sea levels to rise. Nobody expected the ice sheet to lose mass so much mass so quickly. This is a researcher who works on Greenland. So this is now looking not at the major ice sheets, but at glaciers around the world. So this is a glacier in Alaska in 1941, and the same shot in 2004. This is in Argentina in 1928, same shot in 2004, the ice is gone. This is in the Himalayas, 1921, and I think it's 2009. There are many cities around the world which rely on glaciers to get their water supply. La Paz, it's the capital of Bolivia, it's home to about 800,000 people. Its water comes from that mountain in the background, the Illuminati Glacier. This glacier is rapidly retreating. Bolivia is currently in the midst of a record-breaking drought and has declared a state of emergency. They've got water rationing going on currently in the city. The Indus Valley, so it's Pakistan, and the Indus River gets most of its water from the Himalayan glaciers. Again, those glaciers are now rapidly retreating. At least four of the five glaciers that feed into the Indus first of all run through India and the Kashmir region. And there's lots of disputes over how that water is divided between the two countries. So all of that ice melting from both the glaciers and the ice sheets, and also expansion of the water as it warms itself, is causing sea levels to rise, and again, rising at an exponentially increasing rate. These are the predictions for what sea level rise will look like by 2100. And what they've done here is asked experts for what they think their most likely outcome will be in 2100. So what would a 1 meter sea level rise do to a city like New York? So 1 meter sea level rise could raise the frequency of severe flooding for New York City from once per century to once every 3 years. We saw what the effects of that once every century storm looked like when Superstorm Sandy struck New York City, the flooding in the underground stations. It's not just cities, and it's not just New York. It could be Miami, it could be Rotterdam, it could be Bangkok or Shanghai that are at risk. It's whole countries. So this is Bangladesh. And with 1 meter sea level rise, is predicted to displace 15 million people and submerge 17,000 square kilometers of land. With 1.5 meters, you're talking about displacing 19 million people. And the question we've got to ask is, where are these people going to go? Currently, they're going into Dhaka already, but India's building, or already has built, a 10-foot-high fence around its entire perimeter border with Bangladesh, and has now got armed guards patrolling it day and night. Okay, this is a different problem to climate change, but it's related because it comes from our same CO2 emissions. So the oceans are absorbing some of that carbon that we're putting out into the atmosphere. It doesn't just stay in the atmosphere. But as it goes into the oceans, it causes them to become more acidic. The CO2 disassociation becomes a weak acid. And that's causing the oceans to acidify, and they're now 30% more acidic than they were at the start of the Industrial Revolution. If we carry on a high emission scenario, they'll be 150% more acidic by 2100. If we switch to a low emission scenario, we might be able to stop this getting worse. But what it does is it removes from solution the bicarbonate ions, or the carbonate ions, that these organisms that make shells, such as mollusks and crustaceans and corals, use to build their shells. And so as it becomes more acidic, it becomes harder and harder for them to build their shells, and they become more frail, more brittle, and eventually they can't do it. So again, these are the organisms that support the base of the food chain that all the rest of marine life depends upon. Corals are particularly badly hit because not only are they susceptible to this ocean acidification, they're also affected by what's known as coral bleaching. Whereas the temperature goes up and causes heat waves to happen, those heat waves also happen in the sea. And when the temperatures in the sea rise too high, the corals get stressed and they basically bleach. And so the zooanthellae organisms that are the corals, and the symbiosis with the algae that live inside of them breaks down, and so the corals start to starve. By the time we get to 2 degrees of warming, we're expecting bleaching to happen almost on an annual basis. So even at 2 degrees, corals are going to really struggle. Now, many of the world's fisheries depend on corals. So all around the Philippines, Indonesia, many of those people in the Philippines, for example, 90% of their protein comes from fish that is caught from coral reefs. This is an Australian scientist who studies corals. He's now saying that he thinks that 20 years from now, every summer will be too hot for corals and they will disappear as dominant members of tropical reef systems by 2040 to 2050. It's hard to argue it any other way. So all of these impacts will be happening simultaneously, and they'll be getting worse decade after decade. And that's the thing that I struggles to kind of convey a little bit, because, you know, I have to go through them linearly one at a time, but actually you have to think of this as a systemic problem. But climate change is systemic in the sense that it affects everything. So here's some quotes about climate change, right? So climate change is the biggest human rights issue of the 21st century, says the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. It's the greatest environmental threat that humanity has ever faced, says Greenpeace. It is the biggest global health threat of the 20th century, says The Lancet. It presents security challenges of a magnitude and a complexity that we have never seen before, says the former Secretary General of NATO. It is the single greatest threat to sustainable development, says the former UN Secretary General. And it is the greatest market failure that the world has ever seen, says Nicholas Stern, who was chief advisor to the United Kingdom about climate economics. It's all of these things. They're interrelated. So that is why the world has come together to say we have to avoid this. We have to stop this. Again, this is John Holdren. He was the science advisor to Barack Obama. He says, avoiding dangerous anthropogenic interference in the climate is in fact unattainable because today we are already experiencing dangerous anthropogenic interference. The real question is whether we can still avoid catastrophic anthropogenic interference in climate.
That was the first half of a one-hour talk entitled The Brutal Logic of Climate Change by Dr. Aaron Thierry. He received his PhD in ecology from the University of Sheffield, UK, and researched the impacts of global warming on the carbon cycle in Arctic ecosystems. He now spends much of his time lobbying for political action to reduce carbon emissions. Aaron Thierry was one of Sheffield's 50-person contingent in the March for Science in London in April 2017. Thanks to CNU, that's Carbon Neutral University at Sheffield, for organizing and recording this talk. The date was March 26, 2017. You can see all the slides and charts on YouTube. Come back for the conclusion of his talk when TUC Radio returns. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.